This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There is only one state in which physician-assisted suicide is legal, Oregon. Its Death with Dignity Act enables physicians to prescribe a lethal dose of drugs to certain patients who are terminally ill. The act was approved by referendum in 1994 by a narrow margin. 3 years later, a larger majority rejected a referendum to repeal the law. Last fall, Attorney General John Ashcroft issued a directive to strike down the law, ruling that prescribing, dispensing, or administering federally controlled substances to assist suicide violates the Controlled Substances Act. The state of Oregon and several dying patients filed suit against the federal government. A stay is keeping the law in effect until a decision is handed down by federal court. That decision may come down this week. My guest, Dr. Peter Rasmussen, is an oncologist in Oregon. He's one of the few doctors in America who has legally assisted terminally ill patients in ending their lives. We asked him to talk with us about the process and his experiences. I asked about his criteria for prescribing a lethal dose to a patient. He told me the law has several requirements, and he has some of his own.
One is that I feel it's important that I know the patient. I have to have met with that patient several times so that I'm confident that the patient's request is consistent and so on. I also require that a trial of hospice care, because it's not uncommon that somebody who feels that there is no reason to continue living, once they get the good multidisciplinary hospice care for themselves and their family, that takes care of some of the issues and concerns that were troubling them. So I think a trial of hospice is a necessity. The law does not require a psychiatric consultation, but with rare exceptions, I have asked patients if they would be seen by a psychiatrist just as a safeguard, and they've always been willing to do that.
Do you try to talk a patient out of it when they ask you to help them kill themselves?
Well, in a sense, I do. I fundamentally believe that a decision about how a person is going to die is, when possible, up to the patient. I don't think that's something that the doctor should be deciding. So in that sense, I don't try to talk them out of it, but I explore all the other options. I try to find out why they're thinking about suicide, and there are some reasons that I feel are legitimate and others that are not. For instance, there are some people who are just afraid that they'll suffer terrible pain at the end of life. And I can assure them that with modern medicine, nobody has to suffer severe excruciating pain as they're dying. We can prevent that. So often, if I just address what their concerns are, their interest in assisted suicide dissipates.
What are the drugs that are actually being used?
We started using a drug called secobarbital. It's a kind of an old-fashioned sleeping pill and tranquilizer, which is not used very much anymore because of the overdose potential. It's been replaced by the benzodiazepines like Valium. The drug we've been using, however, has become unavailable. The manufacturer is no longer making it, so we're now using a pentobarbital, a close relative, which is designed to be administered intravenously for anesthesia. What we do is we remove it from the bottles and put it into a glass or a tumbler and have the patient drink that down.
And what does it do to their body?
It works very quickly. Typically within a minute or so, a patient gets very sleepy and falls asleep. Goes into a very deep sleep, then a coma, and the patient then dies typically a half an hour to a couple of hours later.
Now, what's your role in actually giving out the drugs? You prescribe the drug, but you're not allowed to actually administer the drug.
That's right. One of the safeguards is that this has to be ingested by the patient. The physician can help in preparing the drug, and if the patient is very weak, we can even help bring it up to their lips or something like that. But it has to be a voluntary act. And there's no provision for lethal injection. That's strictly forbidden.
Dr. Rasmussen, how many people have you prescribed lethal medication for? And of those people, how many of them actually used it?
I've decided not to give absolute numbers, but I know that approximately 60 or 70 patients have inquired about the process enough that they have made a formal request and have completed the written request.
In your practice?
In my practice. Now, most of them, of course, do not end up using the law. One of the reasons that people don't use the law is because many people wait too long, and they're so ill by the time they make the request that they do not survive the 15-day waiting period.
Right.
There are other people who, once we start the process, and make sure they're on hospice, address all of their symptom concerns, many people no longer want to continue the process.
Can you give us a sense of what particular kinds of problems and symptoms have led your patients to ask you to help them take their life with lethal prescriptions?
Yeah, I thought, and I think all of us thought, that the issue was going to be pain.
Mm-hmm.
Because pain is what kind of pops into everybody's head when you think about dying of cancer.
Absolutely.
But the fact is, we really can prevent severe ongoing pain. Sometimes, to prevent that pain, we have to give people such high doses of drugs that they're sleepy all the time or kind of in a narcotic haze. And it turns out that's the bigger concern. People's concern is mostly the quality of their life, their ability to be awake and alert, continue to interact with their family. It's those issues of control over their life, which turns out to be the primary impetus to the request.
That life has ceased to have any point to them?
The law is only available to people who are about to die anyway, and so people are interested in minimizing what they consider to be an inhumane, a pointless dying process. They would rather end their life on their own terms, in their own timing, rather than become bedbound, perhaps lose control of their bowel movements and their bladder, and require ongoing care for that terminal period of time.
Would it be possible to share with us the story of one of your patients without violating their privacy in any way?
Yes. I can think of one patient who was a retired teacher. She had a big family, and she had had a stroke because of a brain cancer. And as she got worse, she requested the death with dignity. When I arrived at her home on a Sunday afternoon, it turns out that her family, which had been scattered all through the country, had come in over the previous Thursday and Friday. And out in their front yard, there were about 30 young people, children, all dressed the girls were in dresses and the boys were in ties. They had just come back from church. And they had been having a weekend-long family reunion. And then I talked with the patient again for a period of time before she took the drug. And before she took it, each of the family members came in kind of one at a time, one nuclear family at a time, to say goodbye to her. And it was a very poignant situation. Then she took the medication and promptly fell asleep.
So this was the death she wanted. She wanted to time it so she could see the people who she cared most about and then end her life.
Exactly.
And that struck you as a legitimate amount of control to have, to kind of like organize your death in a way like that?
I think so. I've seen people die in a lot of different ways, and some of them aren't pleasant and aren't very pretty. And to be able to do it in this way, I think, is a reasonable thing for a terminally ill patient to ask.
Now, how sick was this patient? Was she in a lot of pain? Had she lost control of her bodily functions?
She was becoming extraordinarily weak and fatigued. She also was having increasing difficulty speaking. Her mind was sharp, but her words were very fuzzy, and it took a long time to communicate, even between family members. And because she was requiring more and more care, and she could see that things were only going to continue to get worse, she decided that that was the time to end her life.
Would you tell us a story of another patient?
Another a patient would be a patient with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis who had had a relatively rapid onset and deterioration.
You should explain what that is.
That's a neurologic disease where people's brain function, where people's mental function is perfectly normal, but they progressively lose control of their body, typically starting down with the feet and then rising higher and higher. And she had gotten to the point where she could barely move her arms. She could not grasp a glass or a straw to drink from. She required help eating, and yet her mind was perfectly normal. And as she became increasingly dependent on people, she had decided that she wanted to end her life. If she hadn't, what would have happened is eventually the neurologic problem would have gotten to the level of her breathing, and she would have found it increasingly difficult to breathe. There would be periods of gasping, swallowing saliva into the lungs, choking, and dying in that way.
So death with this disease is usually a very difficult process.
It is.
So did you try to talk her out of it and say, wait a little longer?
In fact, from the time she requested assisted suicide, I think we put it off somewhere between 4 and 6 months. And that's not uncommon. Once people know that they have this option, and they know that they have a physician who is going to be available and is not going to abandon them, then they try to put it off as long as they can, because life is precious and we all want to live. And it's not uncommon at all for people to put it off and put it off and put it off. And some of those people end up losing their ability to use the law. They become either mentally incapable of making that decision, or a disease sets in like pneumonia that takes its own course.
My guest is Dr. Peter Rasmussen, an oncologist in Oregon. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Dr. Peter Rasmussen, is an oncologist in Oregon. He has legally helped several terminally ill patients end their lives. After you give the drugs, do you keep track of what happened?
Well, one of the things I request of patients is that I be present so that I can make sure that the process goes well. I can make sure that on that final day, the patient still has the mental capacity to make his own decisions, has not become clinically depressed. I wait until the patient becomes comatose, and I usually wait until the patient dies, spending some time talking with the family.
And usually go to their home to do this?
Yes, it's always been in the patient's home. I think 3 times it's been in a nursing facility, and 1 time it was in a hospital.
It must be a very, awkward or difficult situation for you, in part because you're not a member of the family, and it's really a time for family and friends to be there, and also, well, because you're presiding over somebody's death.
I've usually met most of the, at least the intimate family members, in the weeks before the patient ends his life. But you're right. It is a very personal situation, and there are times when I fade into the shadows, but I think many family members are reassured by the presence of a physician.
When you've been present at the death, have you ever gotten the sense that there's a loved one who is gathered around who is not at all happy with this decision?
There are times, there are some family members who disagree with the decision of the patient, but I have never found a family member who hasn't agreed that it was the patient's decision to do this. And even though they disagree with it, they recognize his right to do it.
And I'm wondering if it's ever been the other way around, where you have felt that the patient has felt pressured by family to end their life so as to not be a burden, either a financial burden or a physical burden?
No, I've never noticed anything like that, but I've certainly noticed the opposite. Patients, as they're approaching the end of their life, have a kind of a reordering of their priorities. You know, they're no longer interested in making money and owning things, and what's really important often is their family, their loved ones. And it's not at all uncommon for a terminally ill patient to hope that his death and caring for him does not impoverish the family. You know, there are some figures suggest that about a third of patients who die of cancer in this country end up impoverishing their family before they die. And there are a lot of patients who would rather keep some of the family funds available for schooling of the children and so on. So usually it's the patient who is focused on the financial issues, and it's usually the family saying, no, Dad, it's very important that we be with you, and we want you to live as long as you can, and we'll be fine. We want you to hold on. So that's usually the discussion that takes place.
You know, I think you've just hit on one of the real big fears surrounding assisted suicide, which is if somebody does feel pressured, either self-imposed pressure or pressure imposed by the family, to end their life before it becomes too costly. What a kind of awful way to end your life, to save money.
It would be, wouldn't it? And I think that's one of the roles of the physician, is to try to minimize that.
How?
And we always bring it up. It becomes a matter of discussion, because I don't want to participate in a suicide where that is the primary motive. And usually we talk about it, and the family tries to convince, and often convinces the patient, that they really will be okay. But there's no denying the fact that the care required at the end of life is often very expensive. And I think that's a legitimate concern for a patient to have. If it's the only reason that they want a death with dignity, then I would find that unacceptable.
Were there times in the past, before the law, when you wished you could help somebody, or when you knew that they desperately wanted that kind of help?
Yes, but you know, physicians tend to be very conservative, careful people, and I count myself as one of those. And I've not been willing to risk my license by doing that.
I guess I'm wondering if there are things that you've seen, deaths and end of life experiences that you witnessed, that made you think physician assisted suicide can be a positive thing.
Well, one example is people who commit suicide. I have had patients who have committed suicide without my assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And it often involves violence, like a gun, and that's very hard on the surviving family members to encounter their loved one dead of a gunshot wound. Also, I've heard stories of people who perhaps had a potentially curable cancer, but early on in their, right after their diagnosis, they committed suicide before there was even a chance for a doctor to talk with them about treatment options. And so a suicide like that is very tragic, because it was based on ignorance and fear rather than a thoughtful process.
What was your biggest fear when you first started participating in this process?
Well, it was a totally new medical process for me. I had no experience with it. I went with a group of others to the Netherlands to learn about their experience. But any time a physician does a new medical procedure, there's a certain amount of anxiety to make sure it's done properly. That was probably my greatest concern. At the time we were having the political discussion, the ballot measure, there was a lot of talk about complicated suicides, where people would have terrible nausea and vomiting, where they'd have seizures, and it would be a miserable process. And although everything I knew suggested that that was not the case, without actual experience, I couldn't say that for sure. So it was just the unknown that worried me the most.
So experience put your mind at ease in that aspect of it?
It has, yes.
If this isn't too personal a question, I'm wondering if you practice any religion and how, if so, how those religious principles figure in your decision to participate in the Death with Dignity doctor-assisted suicide.
I think it probably is too personal a question. I think that my motivation is really that physician-assisted suicide is a personal liberty. It's a right that people ought to have for themselves. It's not something that a physician or a government should impose or restrict. And that's really my philosophical foundation for believing that physician-assisted suicide is legitimate. I really think it's up to the patient.
Dr. Peter Rasmussen is an oncologist in Oregon. We'll talk more about Oregon's Death with Dignity Act and the challenge against it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Oregon is the only state that legally allows physician-assisted suicide. A doctor is allowed, under certain circumstances, to prescribe a lethal dose of drugs to a terminally ill patient. The law has been challenged by Attorney General John Ashcroft. The state sued the federal government. A federal court may give its decision this week. Let's get back to our interview with Dr. Peter Rasmussen, an oncologist in Oregon who has prescribed lethal doses of drugs to several terminally ill patients. Do you ever feel that you're violating the Hippocratic Oath, which says first do no harm?
The Hippocratic Oath does have a prescription against ending a patient's life. I think that has to be taken in context of the Hippocratic Oath. You know, that goes back to some 300 or 400 years B.C. when what was called physicians were really, I don't know what we'd call them today, faith healers or they certainly did not understand anything about anatomy or physiology. And they had a bad reputation. If you read some accounts from that time, physicians were known to occasionally work for a wealthy merchant or a politician, but also take money from that person's enemy in exchange for poisoning the patient. And it made it real hard for these physicians to get work because nobody really trusted them. And so the Hippocratic Oath was an attempt to say, you can really trust me, I will work for you. And it was the first written social contract where physicians made it clear that the people they were working for, the instructions they were taking, were from the patient, not from other people. And that's why the Hippocratic Oath is so important. It's not particularly important, in my mind, about what it says they will do and what they will not do. For instance, the Hippocratic Oath says that they will not do surgery, because surgery under those circumstances, of course, was very dangerous and people routinely died. And the Hippocratic Oath even says that the medical secrets that physicians learn will only be passed on to the son of another physician. The first do no harm, I think, really does not apply to modern medicine, because there are many things that we do to harm patients. Every time you do surgery, for instance, you drug a patient into unconsciousness and you slice open their body. And that certainly is not following first do no harm.
But you put chemotherapy in that category too, because you're sickening them and
exactly. It's basically
them.
A poison. Mm-hmm. And radiation, likewise. Mm-hmm. So the first do no harm really needs to be replaced by the greater good concept. There are times when people are willing to undergo some injury in order to have a greater benefit.
I wonder if doctors in Oregon are really divided over physician-assisted suicide, and if you have any close friends who are on the other side.
Yes, I do. The medical profession would very much like this whole question to go away. The question of physician-assisted suicide did not come from physicians. it came from patients. It came from people who were who thought that medicine should be offering something other than what we were. It's uncomfortable for us. This is not a type of medicine that we have been trained to practice. It's something new. It's breaking new ground. And it takes a lot of time to talk with these patients, to get to know them, to be absolutely sure that they're making a well-thought-out, considered decision. Takes a lot of time and, frankly, a lot of emotional effort as well. So there are a lot of physicians who don't want to have anything to do with it. And that's one of the reasons I've had patients referred to me who have non-cancerous diagnoses.
Right. Do you ever have doubts about participating in suicide?
I think I have a doubt every time I talk to a patient. I've had many patients ask me for death with dignity who I have refused because I thought they did not qualify for reasons of being emotionally unstable, acting in a precipitous manner, that sort of thing. I've had patients who I thought were depressed, and therefore I've declined to participate. But even in those where everything seems to be okay, it takes a lot of self searching on my part and on the part of any physician to determine whether it's okay to go ahead, because the primary safeguard in the law, frankly, is not the waiting periods and it's not the public reporting or anything. It's the fact that there have to be two physicians who are willing to say that this is okay, and that is a heavy burden, and it worries me every time I do it.
What will your reaction be if the Justice Department wins on this and the Oregon State Death with Dignity law is overturned?
Well, on a real personal level, that would be frustrating for me. But on the big picture level, I think that would be okay, because I really believe that what we're talking about here is a citizen's right to an assisted suicide. And that's a new right, and it's a right that only exists in Oregon. And anytime you're dealing with rights of citizens, it's a political question. And I think it's very appropriate that this be dealt with in the news media. I think there needs to be a lot of public discussion about the pros and cons. And ultimately, it has to be a legal decision ultimately decided by the courts. I think that's the right process. I think it's the right way we should be going about talking about end-of-life care.
Dr. Peter Rasmussen is affiliated with Hematology Oncology of Salem in Salem, Oregon. This is Fresh Air.